The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. With the same employer for four decades is an accomplishment in itself. And in 2009, Ann Hobson-Pilot retired as principal harpist with the prestigious Boston Symphony Orchestra, which she had joined in 1969. Ms. Pilot graduated from the Cleveland Institute of Music, where she studied with another legendary harpist, Alice Chalifou, who was principal harpist with the Cleveland Orchestra for decades. Ann Hobson-Pilot has played all over the world. As a soloist, she has commissioned music for the harp and has had music composed in her honor. She has an impressive list of lifetime achievement awards and honorary degrees from prestigious institutions. Ms. Pilot also has the League of American Orchestras Gold Baton for supporting and inspiring the growth of symphonic music. Other recipients include Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, and Yo-Yo Ma, and she is the only harpist among them. Ann Hobson-Pilot is speaking to me via Zoom about her amazing career as an orchestral musician and soloist, and it is a thrill to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
So first of all, we are about 1 year into social distancing because of a global pandemic. So how are you doing through all of this?
Well, we were fortunate that we feel as if we're fortunate that we had moved to Florida many years ago, which allowed us to be basically outdoors all the time. You know, we could eat outdoors and eat every once in a while go to an outdoor restaurant to eat. And that made it nice. Plus, we have a pool. We're able to swim outdoors. And of course, I'm not doing as much practicing as I ordinarily would because basically all of the concerts that had been planned are canceled, as they are for about everybody. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we're trying to stay healthy and happy.
Yeah. It's interesting that you point out the thing about practicing because I have spoken to a few musicians and like Simona Dinnerstein, for example, the pianist, kind of made a point of saying like she really struggled. You know, she really just sort of the bottom dropped out of the gigs and she just felt, I just can't practice, you know, and then, you know, kind of came back to it. But it is a funny thing when you don't have a gig to practice for. It's hard to do it.
It really is. And it's really hard for me to get motivated to practice I figured out when all this was going on, I thought, well, wait a minute, I've been practicing the harp for 63 years. Maybe I can take a break. So that's what I did. You know, instead of practicing six or seven days a week, I would practice maybe four. Uh-huh. And it actually felt good not to have the pressure to practice every day.
Yeah.
So, I feel badly for younger people who, you know, also have the same issue with not having motivation to practice if there are no concerts upcoming. So that's a little bit harder, but it'll all come back hopefully soon.
Yeah. So your mom was a concert pianist, I believe, and that was your first instrument too, right?
Yes, that's right.
So what inspired you to switch to harp?
Well, I started piano when I was 6 years old, and my older sister, who was 2 years older than I am, played the piano. They thought she was a child prodigy at the time. Mm-hmm. And of course, my mother being a concert pianist, I heard piano in the house all the time. And actually, one day my mother came home because I wasn't practicing the piano and said to me, I've stopped your lessons because I'm not going to pay for lessons when you're not practicing. So I went to where I was going to school at the time was the Philadelphia High School for Girls. And I asked the music teacher there if there was another instrument I could play. Mm-hmm. And after going through a few of them, she recommended the harp because the reading was similar and treble and bass clef and all. And I said, okay, I'll try. Mm-hmm. And I immediately loved it. And it was a unique instrument for me. Not all my friends played the harp, you know. No, yeah. I didn't know anybody that played the harp. Everybody played the piano. Right. And so I did practice, and I was very enthusiastic about it, and I made good progress pretty quickly.
Yeah, there is, you know, there's a lot of romance associated with the harp, you know, the instrument of angels and all those glamorous connotations and whatnot. And it's a very beautiful sounding instrument. It's a beautiful looking instrument, but it's also a very big commitment, you know, difficult to play, exactly. Difficult to transport. You have to have that big vehicle and all. So, you know, when you fell in love with the harp, you know, that was really taking a big plunge. Did your family get on board with that right away?
Not right away, but soon after. The problem, of course, was we had two pianos in our home and not a harp. So I would practice at school. Uh-huh. But then summer came and we were off from school for a couple of months. So my harp teacher approached my parents and said she really does need to keep practicing. So they found a harp in this little guy named Nicoletta, I think his name was, and he rented harps, all these old beat up, broken down harps. He rented them for $15 a month.
Oh, wow.
So this was back then. So I had a harp to practice on and was able to keep working through the summer. And then they kept the harp for me during the next winter. And so I was able to have an instrument at home, which made it a lot easier.
Wow. And I have to tell you that it sounds almost like an oxymoron to say beat up, broken down harp. something so elegant about the instrument. You can't even imagine one in anything but the most beautiful, pristine shape.
Yeah.
So your talent on the harp was evident pretty quickly. And I know that you were playing in a club at the tender age of 18 with some pretty major musical acts, Peggy Lee, Andy Williams, and Johnny Mathis. And I'm dying for you to talk about that experience and especially your Johnny Mathis story.
Right. He was the first one of the group that I played with, a music teacher where I was going to school at the time, which was the Philadelphia Musical Academy. Mm-hmm. Worked there at the Latin Casino, where Johnny Mathis was performing the following couple weeks or so. Mm-hmm. And they needed a harpist. It was the first time they needed a harp. And he liked my playing and asked me if I'd be interested in playing there. And I said, Johnny Mathis, are you kidding? Yes, yes, yes. And so I did. And it was funny because during the first performance, the first concert, when he was singing Chances Are, I'm sure he had already worked this out in his mind, but I had not been told that as he was singing Chances Are, he came over to me, mm-hmm. sitting there behind the harp, and got on one knee and started singing to me. And the audience, of course, was amused and clapping and all, and I was trying to play my harp, and then it turned out that he did that every single night for the rest of the run. So I was prepared for it then, but at the end of the song, he turned to the audience every night and said, "And she's only 18." So that reminds me of how young I was at the time. Another interesting thing was Johnny Mathis came to where we are in Sarasota, Florida, a few years ago. And I mean, I'm not doing that kind of work now usually,
<Of course. laughs>
but the harpist he was supposed to play for him had an accident walking his dog and broke a finger or something. And he knew I had played with him before. So he called and asked me if I would sit in for this one performance. And so I agreed. And the word got back to Johnny Mathis that I had played with him that many years ago. Aww. And so I got to speak with him in his room, and we took pictures and all. So we reunited after a lot of years. Well, what most people don't realize don't know much about the harp is that in addition to the 47 strings, it has 7 foot pedals.
Mm-hmm.
And each pedal is like the, each pedal has 3 notches, mm-hmm. flat, natural, and sharp. And the 7 pedals are for the musical scale, C, D, E, F, G, A, B.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually you are using your legs and feet sometimes as much or more than your hands. So it is a very physical instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty active in sports for a while. I played tennis for many, many years, and I still swim and do things like that. So that helps.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot harder carrying it around. But the first thing you have to do is have a car large enough, or a wagon, usually a station wagon, or now they call them SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always had large cars, and maybe the harp is what helped keep me in shape.
Yeah. Sort of cross training. So your teacher at the Cleveland Institute of Music, Alice Shalafu, was principal harpist for more than 40 years with another major orchestra, the Cleveland Orchestra, and she herself was a trailblazer as the orchestra's only female member for many, many years. And she was a teacher and a mentor who trained you musically, but, you know, of course, relationships can be a little complicated. And I'm curious, would you talk about your experience as her student?
Well, first of all, she was a wonderful teacher. She was really well known, you know, for having very successful students on the harp.
Mm-hmm.
And I was basically sent to her by a woman who I would call my mentor, Edna Phillips. Edna Phillips Rosenbaum had been the principal harpist of the Philadelphia Orchestra when I was very young. And after she retired, she took an interest in me and thought that she wanted me to go to Cleveland, to the Cleveland Institute, to study with Alice, because she knew what Alice can do with her magic as a teacher. And so she arranged for me to get a full tuition scholarship to the Cleveland Institute of Music. And I was there. I'd been at the Philadelphia Musical Academy for 2.5 years, and then I went to Cleveland for 2.5 years.
Mm.
So I was very fortunate to have, you know, the best of teachers and mentors.
That's amazing. And, you know, before you earned your job with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, you played substitute second harp with Pittsburgh Symphony and also principal harp of the Washington National Symphony. Those are also pretty prestigious jobs. And what was your experience playing in those orchestras?
Well, I was second harp in Pittsburgh during my last year as a student at the Cleveland Institute of Music. Mm-hmm. I would go to Pittsburgh as they needed a second harp.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a regular member of the orchestra. But it was fun. My first professional orchestra, of course, was fun. But also my cousin was the keyboard person there.
Oh.
So I had a friend and almost a mentor in a way there too. So that was fun. But then the end of that year in the summer, I was called, I had gone to Marlborough, Rudolf Serkin's Marlborough Festival that summer, and met some pretty important people like Pablo Casals and also Harold Wright, who was the principal clarinet of the Washington National Symphony. And their harpist in Washington had a very severe injury to her hand, and they needed somebody, they thought, for just a year. Well, Harold Wright recommended me, and Rudolf Serkin recommended me, and Alice Shalafu recommended me. So they basically called and offered me the job for the year.
Wow.
So that was a wonderful experience, because as a principal harpist, I had that year experience under my belt.
Yeah.
And after that year, they asked me to stay because they liked my playing and they asked me to stay. So basically I was a tenured player after that.
Wow.
And I did stay for 2 more years. So I was there a total of 3 years when Arthur Fiedler, who came as a guest conductor to Washington, asked me to come to audition for Boston because he wanted me with the Boston Pops.
Wow.
So I auditioned for the BSO and won that job. So there I was for 40 years.
Wow. Wow. Now, in addition to this, you know, remarkable playing career, you have commissioned music for the harp as well. I know you've recorded the harp concerto by American composer Kevin Kaska with the London Symphony Orchestra. So how did that commission come about? And could you talk about the composer? How did you choose him, for example?
Well, Kevin, actually, he lived on the same street as Symphony Hall.
Oh.
And was friend of some other people I knew. So we became friends, and he was very young and very ambitious and wanted to write for harp as much as he could and wanted to write the harp concerto. So I did commission him. His music is very, very warm and easy listening kind, almost.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious to see what he would come up with. And he came up with a concerto that is really very nice. And so then another friend arranged for us to go to London to record it with the London Symphony. So that's how that recording came about.
Mm. Wow. Now, of course, the harp, that's, you know, contemporary. But the other side of the coin is that the harp is a very ancient instrument. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So do you ever play sort of the other end of the chronological spectrum of music?
Not really, because even though the harp is one of the oldest instruments known to man, probably after the drum, you could say, mm-hmm. and the harp gets its roots from the bow and arrow,
mm.
but those very old harps of thousands of years ago, mm-hmm. were very limited in what they could do. I mean, now I was just talking about the seven pedals, which enables us to play in every key. But back then, it was very limited. Sometimes they only had a few strings. And of course, you had to tune each string individually to whatever piece you wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why a long time ago, a lot of the composers didn't write for the harp, because it was such a limited instrument. Mm-hmm. And you could only basically play in one key.
Mm-hmm.
So the only music you hear from composers such as Bach, Haydn, even Handel,
mm-hmm.
Are transcriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the pedal harp was invented in 1810, and then a lot more composers became interested in writing for the instrument, it was invented in France. So a lot of the French composers, Debussy, Ravel, Saint-Saëns, mm-hmm. became interested in writing for the harp. And some of the most beautiful music written for harp is by French composers.
Hmm. So in 2016, I think, you performed at the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Would you talk about that experience? What did that concert mean to you? What was that experience like?
Well, it wasn't actually a concert, it turned out.
Oh.
It was performing while some other things were going on.
Ah.
So but it was very exciting to be there, and we met a lot of very interesting people.
Yeah.
Like Colin Powell and that level of people.
Yeah.
And so it was very exciting, and we got to visit the museum, and, you know, which is just a fantastic exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your former colleague in the Boston Symphony, Dorio Anthony Dwyer, she was one of the first women to hold a principal chair for a major U.S. orchestra. She's the principal flute for the Boston Symphony Orchestra for almost 40 years, so you had her beat there. but, you know, symphony orchestras have not exactly been havens of diversity and inclusion. The fact that we still talk about the fact that, you know, it took that long for women to break through, for example, is something, and we're still talking about that. And, you know, orchestras have sort of notoriously been kind of closed clubs. We talk a lot about making classical music more open and welcoming, but we still have a very, very long way to go. I know that You have spoken in a few interviews about your first day on the job as a member of the Boston Symphony that was, you know, kind of tainted by another orchestra member's comments. Do you want to tell that story?
Well, it was my first rehearsal. Mm-hmm. You know, I had auditioned and won the job with BSO, and I was very excited and was tuning my harp, and then I sat down and was warming up, and this member of the orchestra, older man, came up to me. I expected him to say, you know, welcome to the orchestra or some nice thing like that. But mm-hmm. instead he didn't even say hello. He just said, "You must fry some mean chicken." And I looked at him and I said, "Excuse me?" And he said it again and again, because I couldn't believe I was hearing that. Yeah. And finally, I just had to laugh and say, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And I had been at that time I was the only Black member of the BSO. There had been another man at the end of the 1950s, a bass player, mm-hmm. who probably for those kind of reasons didn't work out. And I don't think he ever got tenure.
Yeah.
But if you get angry at that kind of thing back then in 1969, mm-hmm. It could cause problems for the rest of your career there. But sure. I mean, I really, to this day, I think it's funny that this guy said that. And what it meant was, you know, fried chicken back then, and probably maybe still to this day, is a racist depiction of Blacks. Mm-hmm. So that's what he was saying. As a matter of fact, he was in the orchestra for about 20, 25 years. That, you know, after I arrived there, he was still there before he retired. Mm-hmm. And every time he said anything to me, it had to do with race. Like, oh, I used to play for Porgy and Bess, and the Black musicians had to go in the rear door, and I mean, things like that. Yeah. So, I mean, I recognized that when he looked at me, all he saw was the color of my skin.
Yeah.
So that was my first experience with a job in Boston.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, you know, this dream gig, and yet to have someone like that spoil that first rehearsal. That's heartbreaking. So I it's interesting that you mentioned bass player and also, you know, kind of the current state of things, because I actually interviewed a young musician just a week or two ago who is currently right now in the year 2021, the only Black member of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra. He's a bass player. So what do we music lovers need to do more than just talk about it? What do we need to do to effect some meaningful change?
Well, when I joined the orchestra in 1969, already the audition screen had been invented, I guess you would say, mm-hmm. so that all musicians that auditioned for these major orchestra jobs had to audition behind a screen so that the committee that was judging you could not see you, it could mm-hmm. only hear you. So mm-hmm. you were not going to be discriminated against based on your race, your sex, your height, your age, whatever. They would just listen to you play.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1969, I got the job in Boston behind a screen. 20 years later, Owen Young, a cellist, got the job in Boston. Mm-hmm. And then I left. So there were two of us then.
Mm-hmm.
Then I left in 2009, and he was the only Black player. So obviously in 40 years of the screen, they went from one Black musician to two, then back to one.
Mm-hmm.
But what did improve was the amount of women in the orchestra, because back when I first got the job in Boston, there were four or five women in the orchestra only. And by now, I mean, I have totally lost count, 40s or mm-hmm. More women in the orchestra.
Yeah.
So that was good. But in terms of getting people of color, some people actually think they should take down the screen now,
mm-hmm.
that people would have more of a sensitivity to hiring people of color if they could see them. Mm-hmm. And of course, then there's the other side of that where Black players don't want to be accused of, you know, needing help to get these jobs.
Sure.
So it's a difficult question. Some of the orchestras are now offering some Black players to come into the orchestra, or Latino to come in into the orchestra for a year or two, mm-hmm. To get experience and then to audition. So we'll see how that works.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a difficult problem. And I think there are many reasons for it. Initially, it could be financial reasons. People that are come from a wealthy family, let's say, for example, might have a $100,000 violin to play on, whereas people who don't come from a wealthy family might be having a $10,000-$15,000 instrument to play on. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to compete, you know, at that level.
Sure.
So there are a lot of issues, but hopefully things will change. Now there are a lot of these programs like Project STEP in Boston and mm-hmm. Atlanta Talent Development League in mm-hmm. Atlanta, obviously, that are geared mostly toward Black players, a lot of string players especially.
Yeah.
And so I think that one day there will be a breakthrough.
Yeah. I think the idea of those blind auditions, those screened auditions, I think the intent is ostensibly to level the playing field, but, you know, there's so much more baked into everything that happens before you step onto the stage behind that screen. You know, access to, I mean, and this is a problem of just getting younger people in general interested in classical music. But, you know, if you, as you're saying, there's an economic aspect to this as well. There's just getting someone interested in even considering playing an instrument and then pursuing it at the kind of a high level that's required and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, basically the talent pool isn't being appropriately cultivated or sufficiently cultivated.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're involved with Sphinx Organization. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Sphinx is basically for string players, just mm-hmm. as Project STEP is. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really not very involved in it because the harp is not considered a string instrument, even mm-hmm. though we have more strings than all of them. But they have done incredible things. They've been incredibly successful.
Yeah.
And the other aspect of importance as a young musician wanting to be a professional is getting a teacher that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, first it's the instrument and then it's the teaching, which I was fortunate, as I told you, my Edna Phillips, Alice Shalafu student story.
Yeah.
Because that's very important. Again, if you have someone who's getting the best training, auditioning with a wonderful instrument, then it's important for the young students of color to have good training also. And mm-hmm. that's what organizations like Sphinx and like Project STEP are doing also. They're getting these students good training. They're getting them experience playing in orchestras and chamber music. And so that's why I say, I think the Sphinx even has, well, I don't think, the Sphinx has an orchestra of its own mm-hmm. where all the students play together.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is very important. And so I'm very, very hopeful for the future of orchestras in this country to be integrated soon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, we talk about the performers and the conductors, the composers as well. But also there's the audiences. You know, there are potential audiences that we are not welcoming and embracing in our concert halls. So do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, you know, our audiences for classical music are quite a bit older and quite a bit wider than the general population. And that's a loss because I think there are a lot of people who might, you know, really love and benefit and appreciate this music. And we're not very welcoming in our concert halls.
Well, that's true. I mean, diversity starts at all levels. So it's not only the players on the stage, it's the music they play. You don't often hear music of Black composers or Black soloists even. And so therefore, when you do, a lot of times you will find the audience also becomes more diverse. And so all of those things are layers that the symphony orchestras really need to look at. And if they are interested in, as they should be, because everybody knows the orchestra audiences are getting grayer. They're staying whiter, but they're getting grayer. And so they really do need to open up all levels of orchestral playing so that the audiences also can be more diverse.
As it's said, you know, you see people like you on the stage, you know, and that is inspiring, and that contributes to the experience. You had a pretty, speaking of experiences and inspiring things, in 1997, you traveled to South Africa to make your documentary film, A Musical Journey. And that was, I believe, performance with the National Symphony of Johannesburg and visiting the San indigenous people in Namibia. Would you talk about that? That's a pretty extraordinary lifetime experience.
Right. Well, I had decided to take a sabbatical from the BSO from 96 to 97. And as a matter of fact, I was on the tennis court playing tennis with a friend of mine who worked for WGBH, the PBS station in Boston. And I was telling her about the year that we were planning to go, and that I had contacted the National Symphony of Johannesburg to see if they would be interested in having me come as a soloist, which I would never have done before that time, because before that time, the concerts were, they did not allow Blacks at the concerts. But by this time, apartheid had ended and the audiences were more open. So she said, my friend, my tennis friend said, well, that might be something WGBH would be interested in following. So she said, do you mind if I talk to someone over there about it? And I said, no, of course not. So she did talk to someone and they were interested. So after the concert was set up with the National Symphony of Johannesburg, where I played a soloist, the Handel Harp Concerto, and also a piece by the African-American composer William Grant Still called Ananga. And Ananga is an African harp. They have various kinds of anangas in Africa. They're all, as we were talking about earlier, very small instrument, very limited amount of strings, but it kind of fit in perfectly by going to Africa to take this piece, which was written by an African-American composer, back to Africa, where the instrument came from. So they sent over a film crew, two people, a person who did the filming, and a person who did the lighting, and also the producer, Susan Dangle, who has done a lot of filming for, especially for the Boston Pops, the BSO and the Boston Pops, and works closely with John Williams. And out of that came Anne Hobson Pilot, A Musical Journey, which I think now is you're able to find it on YouTube. And occasionally it is aired on PBS stations, especially during February, Black History.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you say that, because I was looking around for it just, you know, before we spoke and was not able to find it. So I will check out on YouTube. Thank you for that recommendation.
Yeah, I gave a concert in, with these years going so quickly with the pandemic. And I can't remember. It was in November. So it must have been November 2019 because the pandemic started in 2020.
Right.
So in 2019, in November, I was the soloist with the Albany, Georgia Symphony Orchestra. And I was supposed to show the film. I bought the film and I was supposed to show it to the students at the university there. And for some reason, they couldn't get it to work. So she asked me to leave it there with her and said she would return it. Next thing I knew, it was on YouTube. it might be under, I think either Albany Symphony or University of Albany, or I can't remember the name of the university there, but it's part of that series.
Uh-huh. Okay. We will check that out. That's helpful. And if we can find that, we'll put a link as well with this interview so that people can watch that.
Okay.
Well, I have been speaking with harpist Ann Hobson-Pilot, the longtime principal harpist of the Boston Symphony Orchestra and internationally acclaimed soloist. Ms. Pilot, thank you very, very much for this conversation.
Well, thank you.